It's Sam Cedar launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, June 21st, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Chris Hayes, author of Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy, perhaps the most awaited book, for me personally, in the past year. Of course, he's also the host of Up With Chris on MSNBC. Also on today's show, new documents released regarding 9/11 show what we, I guess, already knew, but seem to be unequivocal, show how much the Bush administration and their ilk lied. How appropriate when we talk about the failure of the elites today for this to come out. Simultaneously, also problems with our housing market. Fed trying another stimulus. How appropriate to talk about the failure of our elites. It goes on and on and on. The Attorney General Holder held in contempt, or at least voted to be held in contempt by a committee in Congress. Sort of coincidentally also about the failure of our elites, but a little bit of a bank shot. All that and more on today's program. Quickly, before we get to Hayes, decent news coming out of the G20. Incidentally, a lot of protests going on in the G20 right now. That's down in Mexico, where 20 of the country, 20 G countries are meeting. But coming out of those talks, both David Cameron and President Obama met with Putin. They looked into his eyes, saw that he was a very sweet man, probably promised him that Syria can remain a client state. You can sell all the weapons you want there. You got yours. We got ours. As long as we stay on the right neighborhoods and we don't cross over, we don't need to have a little drive-by. We each have our, it's like The Wire, basically. We each have our neighborhoods. And I guess because Putin feels comfortable that he will retain the customer for his weapons in Syria, British and American officials were convinced that Putin was not wedded to Assad remaining in power indefinitely, and that they would be willing, the Brits and the Americans, to offer Bashar al-Assad safe passage and perhaps even clemency if he would step down. So hopefully This is the first step in future ones to mitigate and to end the violence in that country, or at least I should say the killing. But we shall see. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Chris Hayes, author of Twilight of the Elites. This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. In fact, right now, as a listener of the Majority Report, you can get a free Audible book. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Pick up Chris Hayes' book, Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy, as an audio book. You can get it for free. Why would you not do that? Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. It benefits you. It benefits me. It benefits Chris. It's all free. I'm so restless, I'm bored as a cat. I'm so restless, I'm bored as a cat. I'm so restless, I'm bored as a cat. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a real pleasure for me to have our next guest back on the program. And now, having finally read his book, Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy, which you can purchase right now via our link at majority.fm. Chris Hayes, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for reading it, Sam.
I got to say, I mean, now, we've had conversations about a lot of the things that ended up in this book over the past couple of years, and I've read the excerpts. But I got to say, I was still I was surprised. This is an incredibly ambitious book, and it's a little bit radical. I mean, you know, I don't mean to say that, you know, like I just didn't realize, like, this goes beyond politics. I mean, this is fundamentally a social critique of the way that we do business in our society.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's right. I mean, it is, I think there's part of it that's radical. I mean, I think in some ways, one of the core tensions of the book and one of the core tensions I wrestle with, and I think it comes out in different places, is sort of balancing my kind of radical impulses and my ameliorist liberal reformist impulses. And, you know, and I, at one point I refer in the book to my inner David Brooks, which is not a non-trivial part of me, right? This worry about, you know, traditions and institutional performance and moral norms and things like that. It was a big undertaking. I mean, I was lucky enough that the timing was such that I signed the book and I had about 18 months, which is longer than usually you get. Usually you get only about a year. And the folks at The Nation were really cool about me spending a lot of time writing it. And I didn't have the show yet for most of it. So all of that made it possible.
I feel like another half a dozen books could be written based upon the things that you hit at certain point that would inspire literally a half a dozen other books. I mean, I thought it really is a fascinating book. I'd like to sit here with it, and it's sort of unbelievable. I have like 43. I'll show it to the camera here. I got about 43 different post-it notes through this thing. So let's try.
That's
and
great.
I really enjoyed it. And at one point, I was like, "Oh, gee, this is pretty radical." Let's start. Let's just start with the iron law of meritocracy, because this is this is not just sort of saying there's a not the iron law of meritocracy, but your book is not simply saying that there's a problem for the elites here. There is something not just there is something fundamentally wrong with the way that we in some ways organize our society.
Yeah, I mean, I think the social model we have, which we call the meritocracy, and it's the social model that we've adopted, you know, explicitly and implicitly for over the last 30 years or so. And I think what's interesting about meritocracy, just as a topic, right? A, we don't really debate it or talk about it much because it is pretty foundational. It's the floor that we walk on, right? And it's something that's, I think, consensus, bipartisan consensus. And, you know, Barack Obama uses the language of the meritocracy. Mitt Romney uses the language of the meritocracy. And I think liberals and conservatives. I mean, I think we have different definitions of it and different feelings, but it's a pretty deep part of the way that we think about how American life should be. And one of the ironies about the word, which I read about in the book, is that, you know, the word was coined by a leftist British social critic and parliamentarian named Michael Young, who wrote this book in 1955 called The Rise of the Meritocracy, in which he coined the term. And it was this dystopic vision of the future in which intelligence testing and productivity testing within firms had grown incredibly precise, and they had given up on the idea of democracy. And they say that explicitly. Like, we realize that democracy could be no more than an aspiration. Instead, what we want is a meritocracy, which is, you know, ruled by those with the most merit. You know, they test to figure out what students should get the best jobs and who inside an organization is delivering the most value, and they elevate them to positions of power. And Young was writing a dystopic satire, right? I mean, Young was basically saying, this is a horrible vision for how to order a society. And he was aghast at the end of his life to see the term be adopted positively. I mean, in America, when you call something meritocratic, you are praising it. And when you call something bureaucratic, you're insulting it, right? I mean,
right. I mean
no one ever says...
And I want to just back up here a little bit so that people can really sort of firmly grasp this, because as we speak of the meritocracy in this country, we're talking about, like, if you're smart, you'll rise to the top. If you are, there's not going to be any nepotism. There's not going to be any sort of, you come from one class, so you deserve this. And this was a notion that probably, I mean, we've had in this country for a long time. It was just sort of more narrowly, it was, you know, this applied in the same way that all men are created equal,
applied to just a
narrow sect of people. So
that's exactly right. It's sort of a new version of an old dream, right, of boundless mobility, of being able to rise from any station as far as your talents and abilities will take you. De Tocqueville noted this aspiration, right, when he wrote about the U.S., he said, this is a place that doesn't have the inheritance of feudalism. Doesn't have the word peasant because the class is unknown here. Of course, that's because we had slaves, but that's another story. So the meritocracy is a way of it's two things. Okay, it's a social model that you describe where we say we won't bar people from entrance into the elite based on their religion and their race and their creed and their geographic origins. And in fact, Barack Obama is the crowning glory. The crowning achievement of that system. Only under this system of meritocracy could a man from his background with his name and skin color go through, you know, an elite prep school and then Harvard and Columbia and Harvard Law and go on to become president of the United States. And that's, I think, a point in the meritocracy's favor. I mean, I think it's an incredible thing that someone like Barack Obama could be president. But at the same time, the notion we have of dividing neatly the quality of outcomes, right, which is how much money people make and how much power they accrue from a quality of opportunity, the mythical level playing field, we want to divide those two and say we're going to focus on equality of opportunity. And what I argue in the book and what I talk about in terms of the iron law of meritocracy is that they cannot be divided. That ultimately inequality of outcomes come to subvert, co-opt, and destroy the attempts to provide equality of opportunity.
And so people should understand that what you argue throughout the book is that meritocracy as a system ultimately cannot work. Is that accurate? It's fatally flawed.
That it contains the seeds of its own destruction. That it is not. It's not a stable final state, that it always tends towards oligarchy, that it will always be the case that the people who make it to the top find ways to game the system so that they can stay at the top or that their kids can stay at the top. And, you know, we see this in all kinds of ways. I mean, just real flagrant violations, right? Legacy admissions at elite colleges or admissions for the students, the children of extremely wealthy people who donate a wing to a science lab at a, you know, Ivy League university. But we also see it in less flagrant ways. I mean, at my high school embodies this meritocratic vision, Hunter College High School in Manhattan, amazing place, public magnet school starting grade 7, open to kids from all 5 boroughs, free. And I took the test when I was 11 years old, standing outside on a cold winter day, along with a lot of other kids, a lot of outer borough strivers. You know, it's an amazing engine of social mobility, or could be. And what we've seen over time at the school is that the inequality of the city has meant that Black and Latino students are underrepresented, and white and Asian students are overrepresented. And that has gotten worse as a test prep industry has grown up around the test for the school. So you have $90 an hour tutors in Manhattan, you have in the Queens, you have cram schools where you pay $1,000 to send your kid to a school for a week and over winter break and study for the test, and now you're seeing the number of Black and Latino students dwindle to 3% and 1% respectively, and people inside the school worrying about the first class that they will admit that won't have a single Black or Latino student. And this is a perfect example of how even the most austere vision of meritocracy, right? I mean, the great thing about Hunter is that it really is one test, and it isn't that gameable. I mean, if Mayor Bloomberg's daughter failed the test, she wouldn't be able to get in.
Right. Let me ask you: are we talking about sort of the corruption of the meritocracy? In other words, the corruption in the sense that the system doesn't work, or that there's something ultimately wrong about the system. When you talk about it in the dystopic version, this is the type of thing that we hear about in places like the former Soviet Union or in North Korea. You know, if the kid at age 7 shows that they have an aptitude for ballet or for gymnastics, this is what they're going to do. Period. And this is the way those things are sort of their roles and their futures are laid out. Is the problem that the meritocracy as a system ultimately will eat itself, or is that it starts out fundamentally wrong?
You know, that there's a tension, I think, that I haven't resolved in the book about between those two. The argument I'm making is actually about the fact that it will ultimately eat itself. But I also think the vision of it is in deep tension with our democratic commitments. I mean, you know, democracy, in Michael Young's book, The Rise of Meritocracy, meritocracy is explicitly advocated as a kind of repudiation of democracy. And I think that we've gotten away from just how radical the small d democratic commitment is, that we all will make decisions together about what we all are going to do. And that means, at its core, the people you ride the subway with, the people that you stand in line with at the grocery store, the people at work who you cannot stand, right? I mean, and there's that vision, which is what the vision of democracy is a really, really radical one. And it's one that I don't think we really appreciate or embrace anymore that much.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the other problems with the meritocracy as it stands is that We also don't necessarily have an appreciation of the sort of the arbitrariness as to what we value. I mean, you talk in the book about the culture. I think you call it the culture of smart.
Cult of smart.
And, you know, what we seem to have, you talk about two different periods of equality, the one, you know, essentially starting in the 60s till now, and the one prior to that, where one was a more economic equality and then one became more socially emancipated equality, which mm-hmm. led to or didn't necessarily lead to, but coincided with a greater increase in economic inequality. But it seems to me that the values that ultimately we now refer to that dictate the meritocracy did not necessarily absorb the new values that may have come in broadening who could participate in it. Does that make sense?
I mean, I think one of the problems with meritocracy is that upon further investigation, merit is tougher to define than it might first look, right? Like, that's a huge issue with the entire system, because, you know, what we end up defining it at is in a, you know, on Wall Street, it's how much money you can produce. And in you know, higher education and law school, and so forth, it's intelligence. But it's intelligence defined in a very narrow way, which is how well you test, which is just quite distinct from the actual attribute of intelligence. And so I think that the flattening effect that has is really, really destructive. And it produces the fact that we think in very one-dimensional ways about who has value, right? We think about, you know, that that is something, you know, talking about the era between the New Deal and the 1970s and high levels of unionization. You know, the labor movement is a repudiation of that idea. The labor movement says that everyone has value because of the work they do, right? That it's not that it's not just the intellectual superstars and the A students who have value. Everyone has value, and everyone should have good work, and everyone should have work that rewards them and allows them a certain degree of comfort, particularly in a wealthy and affluent society like our own. And I remember having this moment when I was reporting on Detroit for the book, which I ended up not including any of it in. But I drove up to the house of an auto worker in Grand Rapids, and he's a retired auto worker, really, you know, fascinating guy who'd done a lot of writing and pamphleteering and been active in the union and had been battling the union hierarchy for a lot of reasons. And I drove up to his house, and I had this thought flash in my mind about, you know, this house looks like the kind of house that if it was in Brooklyn or in the New York area, would be owned by someone who is a partner at a major law firm, right?
Uh-huh.
And then I thought, oh, that's the whole point. Like, that somehow really clarified exactly the difference between these two visions. Because the vision we have now is the vision that you only get to have that kind of house if you go through all these hoops, if you battle through this set of competitions to get this scarce resource at the top. And the vision that we had before that was embodied by the labor movement was a vision that, no, if you work, if you do productive work, you can have a nice house, right? And that's a very different vision than the meritocracy. The meritocracy is part of what makes it so intensely distorting in terms of people's psychology and neuroses and competition, is that it takes for granted that there's going to be some scarce small set of good jobs and fulfilling endeavors at the end of the funneling process. And so everything from the time that you start jostling to get your kid into the right kindergarten in New York is a lifelong competition for that incredibly scarce resource. But that's a perverted way of thinking about an economy. I mean, we should be thinking about an economy that produces lots of fulfilling good jobs and opportunity for lots of different people.
The rules that structure that competition. In other words, you know, if we sat on a soccer field and we decided at one point that, like, no, the winner's not going to be the one who gets the most goals. the winner is going to be the one who keeps the ball in play for the longest. I mean,
that's right.
It's a completely arbitrary decision that we're making at that point. And if it could very well be that keeping the ball in play for a long time brings out a bunch of ties. And
right.
every
right.
And that's right. really where it gets to. I you know, and this is I mean, that's why I think to a certain extent the book is the fairly radical, because I think I don't think that people realize just how much we have internalized this notion of not just the idea of a meritocracy, but a very specifically defined idea of a meritocracy.
Yeah, that's right. And that
values attributes that lead to hyper competition, and you talk about
hyper competition, and also self justification. I mean, the most perverse consequence of this is this: what Karen Ho, who's this great anthropologist who wrote a great study of Wall Street that called Liquidated, that I cite in the book, which she calls the meritocratic feedback loop. I mean, this worshiping of this cult of smartness, in which you think about smartness as this very easily identifiable, definable, and ordinal trait, right? Like height. Michael Jordan is shorter than Yao Ming, but he's taller than Danny DeVito. So-and-so is smarter than so-and-so, but not as smart as such-and-such, right? That's a really perverse way about thinking about people and about competition and about ranking. Even more perverse is the meritocratic feedback loop on Wall Street, in which money itself is what merit is. If you make a lot of money, then that shows, by definition, that you are deserving. That's a dangerous, dangerous way of thinking about making money, because it's naturally self-justifying. And that is the culture on Wall Street, very, very explicitly the culture on Wall Street. That number, that bonus that you fight for at the end of the year, that is your value. That is your merit. That is a reflection of it, and in some senses, an objective reflection of it.
You talk about how this destroyed. This was what Enron was at the end. I mean, I'm in the midst of reading another book about the big Bayou hedge fund fraud, and it's all. I mean, it literally is. You know, it's all about this notion of how money is self-justifying, how the elite have essentially been corrupted by this notion. Every guy that this guy met in his way to creating this sort of fraudulent hedge fund, which was ultimately taken down because he got conned, was all... This guy got conned because he thought that he was told by a con man that there was a even more secret rigged international bond trading market that only the super elite. And
that,
I mean, it really does describe how this sort of notion where this feedback loop begins to sort of it both justifies where they are and creates the notion that there are people sort of on top of them in some way.
You always have to keep scrambling up the ladder. I mean, there's two aspects of this. One is, I cite C.S. Lewis giving this incredible address.
Well, that was the next thing I wanted to go, because this is fascinating to me. Tell us about this.
He has this. It's a beautiful speech, beautiful essay. You can look it up online. It's called The Inner Ring, and he basically says, you know, he's talking to these people about to graduate. He says, have you ever had the experience, and I think this relates to the point you were just making, you ever had the experience where you walk into a room, there's two people speaking, and they hush up when you walk in? Then you have had the experience of coming up against the inner ring. It's the knowledge that there's some inner ring that you are on the outside of. And C.S. Lewis says, you will find in your life that the desire to be on the right side of that dividing line, to be on the inside of the inner ring, will be the seedbed for corruption, for almost everything you do in your life that is wrong. You will look back on your life, and when you will identify those moments of transgression, the moments you're ashamed of, as having been undertaken because of the desire to be in the inner ring. And I think that's a profound moral insight. And I think at some level, the system of meritocracy is nothing if not a series of inner rings. Explicitly, it's a funneling process. It's constantly wanting to be closer to the core of power or the core of status or the core of money. And so it is also a constant a system of constant temptation for corruption. And one of the things you see in the book, when you talk about, you're talking about the hedge fund, which is a perfect example of that, right? He thought he was on the inner ring, but then there's right. some other secret inner ring that is a super secret deal that ends up being his undoing. But also in environments, Enron and Major League Baseball are two that I talk about along with Wall Street. In environments that are explicitly designed along meritocratic lines, that have high rewards for performance, punishment for failure, it turns out it's trickier than it looks to design a system with high rewards for performance that isn't also a system with high rewards for cheating. And that's basically what happened in Major League Baseball. At a certain point, the norm against cheating broke down. As soon as someone introduced steroids and saw that it was advantageous, the ceaseless competition of the system meant that it was widely adopted. And that happened in Enron. I mean, let's remember, Enron has huge, huge bonuses at the top and also fired 10% of their workforce every 2 years in what they called rank and yank for the lowest rated employees. And people that, here's the thing, people that worked at Enron will tell you it actually was a pretty meritocratic place. They liked that about it. It wasn't bureaucratic. It wasn't about the favored son of some manager. But of course, the flip side of that is exactly the kind of moral decay that we saw. And that, I think, is a really important point, because I think when we think about meritocracy, we don't think about the cost of it. We don't think about these incentives and seductions towards corner-cutting, corruption, breaking moral norms.
And, in fact, this is what I think people who rail against the so-called school reform movement with all of this testing, that's what they're really concerned about, is that you're setting up a system which measures the value of a school based on these metrics that supposedly fit into whether or not the school merits more funding or to continue on or a special place. And all that it does is it increases the pressure to cheat, and it undercuts the value of education.
Yeah, I mean, we're under a national experiment in which we're converting the model of teachers from a bureaucratic one to a meritocratic one explicitly. That is the goal, right? Accountability, punishment for failure, rewards for performance in the form of merit pay, constant measuring and metrics, and competition amongst teachers to produce those numbers. And the analysis in my book suggests we should not be surprised if we see an epidemic of cheating. Because that's what those kinds of systems produce, and we are seeing it. You know, what's happening in Atlanta is jaw-dropping. You have principals hosting pizza parties where people come in and they change test numbers, right?
Well, at least they're giving them pizza. That really gets to the nub. I mean, you don't touch on the school movement, but that notion of the meritocracy it encourages cheating, and I want to just double back, because you know, you talked about these two eras of equality, and I wonder, because by the end you talk about you start getting to when you start talking about the Reformation, you start talking about the problem with meritocracy is that it's sort of a bank shot to equality of outcome in some respects.
Right.
And I wonder if when we moved into this new era of equality, I mean, as flawed as it is, but at least this era of more social emancipation, where theoretically a more diverse group of people could participate in what we now call the meritocracy, if that wasn't sort of the last vestige of trying to maintain power by those people who now had to admit the broader society into this competition, because it is one where you could, despite the fact that theoretically, well, all the inputs are the same, you can then still fudge what the outcomes are, because you still have this sort of meritocracy machine still has sort of inputs that are on the side, and you could sort of,
right.
I don't know,
right.
jerry-rig a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a fascinating question about whether the connection between, and this is a deep one, it's a profound one, I think, for people with the politics that you and I have, in which we are committed to both things. We're committed to you know, we're committed to equality along lines of gender and race and sexual orientation, and we're also committed to economic equality. There's a real question about, you know, the relationship between those two trends, the relationship of the trend of opening up the American elite to a more diverse group of people and the decline in the sense of solidarity and collective, you know, collective purpose that was the hallmark of the labor movement specifically, but the economic left in the middle of the 20th century. And I do think there's a relationship, and I do think that what we see now is the story about meritocracy is used to justify the current distribution of outcomes quite explicitly. I mean, that is what Mitt Romney says when Barack Obama talks about education. You know, he talks about inequality. He chalks up the problem with inequality largely to an educational problem. And that's the social consensus at the moment is we're going to ask the education system to expiate the sins of the rest of society. But, you know, we need to reclaim, and this goes back to what I was saying before about the house in Grand Rapids, you know, reclaim the vision of shared broad affluence. That was the big mid-century promise of America, which we can deliver today. I mean, people talk about foreshortened horizons and decline and all these things. America remains an incredibly wealthy country. It's an incredibly wealthy place, an incredibly productive country with tremendous productive capacity. In fact, huge amounts of productive capacity, which we are simply not using right now right. because of this austerity fever, because of the effects of the recession. And there's a story, you know, there's a story that you will hear from hedge fund guys and private equity folks and relatively sophisticated conservatives, conservative economists that says, you know, that period of wage compression in mid-century, you know, that was just a one-off deal where the rest of the world was recovering from the war, we had incredible growth, and we were able to kind of get fat. But that's not the way it is in this new competitive global environment. And remember, competition is the key theme here. In fact, if you read Friedman's The World is Flat, it's very explicitly a story about global meritocracy, right? Right. Where, you know, the hardworking and hard charging brainiacs of India and China are going to come eat our lunch. And, you know, I just refused. If you look at the facts, America remains a wealthy place. We produce a lot of wealth. We produce a lot of economic activity. And there are different equilibria at which that the distribution of those gains can be. And that's a simple, brute fact that we just don't talk about enough.
Well, I mean, our whole society structure. I mean, we could see that debate when it comes to healthcare, because, you know, it's the, well, where do the princes from Saudi Arabia go to get healthcare? Well, that's fine, but is that really the measure we want of good healthcare when outcomes for the broad amount of people is not as good as it would be in Europe? And I would argue that that President Obama's embrace of the meritocracy, as you describe it in your book, is also a strong, I think it's a reflection of the decisions that he made in terms of bailing out the banks and the way that they built his team to look at what to do with the banks. It was all yep. with the winners who sat atop of this heap, despite the fact that they clearly, or at least they were playing a specific game where the winnings go to the winners because they're winners and that's what winnings do. I mean, it just sort of the circular argument. He could very well have decided we're going to bail out the banks by directly bailing out the mortgage holders who will then help the banks rather than saying to the banks, here's some money, we're going to bail you out, please do the right thing. I mean, it's the difference, it seems to me, of incentivizing the society's winners to help out the rest of us versus helping out the rest of us and right. allowing society's so-called winners to sort of benefit from that.
Yeah, that the really extreme version of this vision, which is the Ayn Randian version of it, which is the winners, the job creators, the idea that actually those folks are a different species of person, right? And there are different species of person that need, that are almost like the ancient Greek gods, who might grow angry with us if we do not placate them. That's really the narrative we get from the Republicans. But it's simply a difference in degree of the way that we think about the meritocracy and the, you know, the brightest folks, rather than a difference in kind. It's simply an extreme extension of that same logic, which concedes that there's some small group of people who should, quote, be in charge. And that when you talk about the book being radical, questioning that fundamental insight, I think, is radical, particularly in the current political context. And at the same time that you call it radical, you know, I had someone who is quite radical read the book and said, you know, this was disappointingly conventionally liberal. and I wrote back and said, you know, in many ways I am. I'm a conventional Rawlsian liberal, John Rawls' theory of justice, redistributive justice. But being a conventional Rawlsian liberal in these times is totally radical, because our political conversation is so far from that. It's so far from thinking explicitly about justice, about redistribution, about equality, about our egalitarian commitments front and center as an affirmative vision for a good society. We don't talk in those terms.
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting, because I think politically speaking, when you start to talk about the Reformation, I mean, it's very hard at this point to say, like, how do you unwind this and what's right. going to do it? But I think socially speaking, if the idea of the meritocracy, which I think, you know, people don't even discuss this. I mean, I haven't seen many, you know, it's certainly not in the context of politics. That's right. always that's you know, where people can agree. And then we start to have different arguments about, branching off from that. But undercutting that very notion of meritocracy, I think, would necessarily lead to political calculations and political movements that would be fundamentally different, because you're starting from a different baseline. It's just that it is so accepted, this notion of meritocracy, that, you know, it's like President Obama said in terms of why we couldn't have a single payer. It's just not American in some way. And I think it's only become American more recently, and it is I think it is a reaction to essentially that social emancipation, that we need another mechanism in which to maintain some dominance here.
Hierarchy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the last thing I want to say in terms of solutions and so forth is, you know, I would love to, you know, Conor Friedersdorf is a really interesting, idiosyncratic, kind of center-right conservative, but with, you know, his views are hard to characterize. And he wrote a review of the book on The Atlantic, and he said, you know, I like the book and I like the analysis, but I thought his suggestions were obtuse and totally off the mark, and here are what my proposals for, you know, how to fix these problems, how to either recalibrate or reform or replace this meritocratic vision in a way that'll, you know, confer some of the concrete benefits we want. And I was just so heartened by that, because I would love to have a debate. As you said, we don't debate this. I would love to have an explicit debate about it, because we just take for granted this is a social model and it's meant to produce what we want it to produce, and even though it's not producing that. And I would love to have a debate with conservatives, with people from all over the political spectrum, explicitly about whether this social model is working, whether we want to maintain it, if we want to get rid of it, what the America after meritocracy looks like. That would be, I think, a really, really good conversation for us to have.
Yeah, it's certainly well needed. And you anticipate in the book that we're going to have these opportunities, because there's really no there's little reason to believe that we're not going to be faced with crises like the one we went through a couple years ago, and are still continuing going through in many respects. in the years to come. My favorite line was just when you said at one point, like, normalcy must be disrupted. And I mean, I know, you know, we've talked in the past about the Occupy movement and clearly there needs to be some type of major social movement. You talk about Frances Townsend, who started to basically create a movement for creating an old folks pension system that with forcing FDR's hand.
Roosevelt's hand. Isn't that a great piece of hidden history? I think it's just an amazing story. But yeah, I mean, I think, I do think, you know, one of the weird things about our current moment is that we're kind of idling. You know, the people in charge did do one thing right. When I say people in charge broadly, I say Hank Paulson, Ben Bernanke, Timothy Geithner, President Obama, Rahm Emanuel, in that period between Lehman Brothers failing and, you know, say the next spring, right? The people in charge did succeed in preventing cataclysm. And cataclysm was absolutely a possibility. And they deserve credit for preventing cataclysm. But the perverse consequence of it is that we now idle in this, what I describe in the book as, we are stalked as a patient with a persistent fever might be, that the feeling isn't, things aren't right, that we haven't gotten better. We're not on our deathbed. We're not in a coma. We're not in the ICU as we could be, but we are also not healthy. And that produces a weird politics because there's a seduction of the normal, even though the times are abnormal. That's part of what Paul Krugman is tearing his hair out on the pages of the New York Times op-ed page in his book, saying, this is not normal. We cannot acclimate ourselves to this normality. And that's why the politics of disruption are so necessary.
Is to make people realize that this is a problem. And I think, you know, I think we can't sustain this fever for forever. I mean, the question is, you know, at what point does it start to aggregate? At what point, when you have all right. of these people who have fallen off the unemployment rolls, at what point does it start to sort of reach that critical mass where it comes back? And hopefully we're you know, I mean, there's reason to believe that we're almost at that point again. But yep. I guess we'll see. Chris Hayes, I love the book. So glad you could come on and talk about it, and I appreciate your taking so much time.
Oh, I love that you love it, and I really appreciate that you read it, and this is a great conversation, and we'll talk soon.
Okay, good. Chris Hayes, folks, we've got to take a break. That is the end of the lesser half of the program. Can you believe that's the lesser half of the program? Folks, your support of this show makes it possible. We don't have any, there's no institutional support. There's no foundational support. The Ford Foundation doesn't give us money. The unions don't give us money. Coca-Cola doesn't give us money. I don't really have time to list all the people, all the entities that don't give us money. I could probably pre-tape the rest of the year's shows by going on a list of all the institutions that don't give us money.
I think more than a year.
Right. It could be a
decade's worth of shows.
In fact, maybe that should be a spinoff podcast if we could get revenue. Nobody's paying for this. You can, however, pay for this. Conversations like this, other conversations, and so it's your support that will keep this show alive and make us able to make the show better. So, you know, we get some cash if you buy your Amazon junk through our Amazon link, and we get some cash if you buy justcoffee.coop, fair trade organic coffee if you want. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, 10% off. But nothing, it really is a fraction of what we get from members, which is a fraction of a fraction of what we would get if we were a, I don't know, a small cable network, a funded show by the Americans for Prosperity, whatever it is. So your support will keep the show alive. And as a bonus, we give you more, we give you more content. We give you swag if you want. Coming up in the better half of the program, as we call it, from a marketing standpoint. It's tough to beat that, though. These 9/11 documents that have been released, like I said, didn't tell us anything new, but it's a little more pointed. We'll get to that story about the Republican who's surrounding himself with kids. Dan Quayle, son, I should say. Son of Dan Quayle. Almost a parody in terms of his complaining about the idea that kids who were brought into this country by no decision of their own, who have now sort of succeeded by graduating high school or serving in the military, they don't deserve anything, according to this guy who is sitting in Congress because his dad was picked as vice president, or at least nominee. Wonderful. Just wonderful. All right, folks. What else? Would you get something else? You were itching.
What?
Oh! And Romney.
Oh, yeah, that story. I was
That
gonna...
story. That's so
Mitt Romney putting Republican governors in what? Sticky situation, I guess you can say?
Yeah.
Sticky situation?
Yeah. Poor Mitt Romney. Honestly, this guy is... I actually think that he may get like a 1% to 2% bump in just a sympathy vote by the time we get to the end of this campaign.
I'm thinking of voting for him at this point, just out of pure sympathy.
It's unbelievable. All right, folks, see you in the better half.